This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, March 12, 2008. From Pacifica Station, KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. The Bolivian government makes its case that the coca leaf should not be categorized as an illicit drug. We'll hear about the fallout and hopes surrounding the resignation of a top U.S. commander. Plus, a new investigative report reveals that the National Security Agency may be spying on you. All that and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. The United States and Germany have agreed to share biometric data, including fingerprints and DNA, in the latest transatlantic anti-terror initiative. Sinema Nippard has more from Berlin.
Under the new system of data exchange, each country can send DNA or fingerprints to be cross-referenced with the other's database. If there's a match or hit, the querying country must then make an official request for further identifying data. The agreement between the United States and Germany is based on a treaty which emerged following the 2004 train bombings in Madrid and allows the seven EU countries that signed it to exchange data more easily. However, German critics say the agreement violates domestic privacy laws, and Germany's independent privacy commissioner, Peter Schaar, says it risks violating the civil liberties of asylum seekers and activists. In Germany, the data-sharing agreement must still be ratified by the German parliament before becoming law. Germany's interior minister hopes to see this implemented by the end of 2008. In the meantime, the US is hoping to secure similar bilateral agreements with other EU member states. Sinema Nippard reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Berlin.
Four people have been indicted for a 1999 fire at a research facility at Michigan State University, attributed to the Earth Liberation Front. The building targeted in the arson housed agricultural biotechnology experiments and research. No one was harmed in the blaze, but the university estimates it caused over $1 million in property damage. In the indictment, authorities linked the four to the destruction of logging equipment elsewhere in the state the following day. Radical environmental groups that engage in property destruction, like the Earth Liberation Front, are considered domestic terrorists by the FBI. In other news, the Tibetan capital has been the scene of two rare pro-independence protests this week as Tibetans commemorate an uprising against China ahead of the 2008 Olympics. Severin Bardon reports from Beijing.
A second day of rare protests occurred in the Tibetan capital of Lhasa yesterday when up to 600 monks marched to the local police headquarters. The protesters were demanding the release of monks arrested on Monday after a demonstration marking the anniversary of 1959's Tibetan uprising against China. According to a Radio Free Asia report, the monks were received by up to 2,000 policemen and by tear gas. Chinese authorities acknowledged the first demonstrations and the arrests without saying how many monks have been detained. The protests have been qualified by China as some monks doing some illegal things that challenged social stability. The situation is increasingly tense in Tibet, with pro-independence activists worldwide using the opportunity of the upcoming Beijing Olympics to voice their demands. No official reaction to this second day of unrest in Lhasa has been made public so far. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Séverine Bardon in Beijing.
Hundreds of Tibetan exiles in India are 3 days into a pro-independence march back to Tibet, despite orders from Indian police to stop. Bismillah Gilani reports.
The Tibetan exiles' return march to Tibet was banned by Indian authorities hours after it began on Monday as part of a global protest to mark the 49th anniversary of the National Tibetan Uprising. The marchers were issued police notices instructing them not to leave the jurisdiction of Dharamshala town, the seat of the Tibetan government in exile led by the Dalai Lama. The exiles defied the ban by continuing their march for the third day today. Tibetan exiles worldwide have planned a series of other campaigns ahead of the Beijing Olympics. In New Delhi today, police baton charged and took into custody dozens of Tibetan refugee women as they tried to storm the Chinese embassy after it opened this morning. The activists who were holding Tibetan flags, banners and placards chanted "Free Tibet, No Olympics in China." The protests marked the anniversary of a 1959 uprising in Tibet against Chinese rule, which was crushed by the Chinese army, driving the Dalai Lama into exile. India is home to the majority of an estimated 1.4 million Tibetans living in exile. For FSRN, this is Bismillah Gilani from New Delhi.
New York Governor Eliot Spitzer resigned today over a scandal that links him to a prostitution ring. Lieutenant Governor David A. Patterson will now become New York's first black governor. In other political news, Barack Obama has won Mississippi by a large margin, with the strong support of black voters. Exit polls from the state's primary show that African Americans made up 44% of all voters, 90% of whom voted for Obama. Hillary Clinton did well among whites over 60. Both candidates are now focusing their campaigns on Pennsylvania. Those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
Is your phone being tapped? Are government officials reading your credit card statements? A Wall Street Journal investigation revealed that the National Security Agency has been spying on Americans in what is being condemned as a blatant violation of a congressional ban on domestic surveillance. This news breaks amidst new negotiations on the foreign surveillance bill in the House. FSRN's Tanya Snyder has more from Washington.
The debate over surveillance that has embroiled Congress for over 2 years reached a new pitch as reports surfaced that the National Security Agency has engaged in domestic spying in violation of a congressional prohibition and their own mission to handle only foreign intelligence. The NSA's role in monitoring huge volumes of emails, internet searches, banking information, and travel records was news to Congress. Democrat Bill Pascrell of New Jersey.
Representatives from the Congress are on the various intelligence committees. Many of them are surprised as well when we hear these things, and that's not good in a democracy.
5 years ago, Congress scrapped a Pentagon proposal called Total Information Awareness, a far-reaching domestic spying program that they worried would curtail civil liberties. But according to the Wall Street Journal, the NSA took the pieces of the Total Information Awareness proposal and secretly cobbled them back together into the current program, funded by the Pentagon's so-called black budget, where it would be less visible. Barry Steinhardt of the American Civil Liberties Union called for an investigation.
But it was, after all, the Congress in the Wyden Amendment who said you can't do this. Cannot do, apparently, what the NSA and the federal government have done here. And it seems to us that Congress has an obligation to itself and to the American public to find out whether that prohibition has been violated and take actions to remedy any violations.
The information that comes out of this vast NSA data mining program can then be passed on to one of many government intelligence agencies, including other branches of the NSA, for follow-up. Domestic surveillance has been at the center of controversy, and news of the NSA's participation adds another element to the ongoing debate in Congress over the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA. This comes as Congress prepares to introduce a new version of FISA legislation this week. In this new legislation, Democrats in Congress tried to allow a greater degree of protection for Americans. Democrat Jared Nadler of New York says he supports the new version of the FISA bill.
This bill does everything that is necessary to be done. Does it in a way that protects civil liberties, inhibits no intelligence gathering, and hopefully the Senate will come around at some point. And the administration will never come around to anything because they don't care about the issue. They're just complete demagogues.
Republicans are standing by the Senate version of the bill because it gives immunity to telecommunications companies that cooperated with the spying programs by handing over to the federal government citizens' telephone, email, and internet records for monitoring. Those companies are now the target of dozens of lawsuits. Though the new version includes some protections for the companies, it stops far short of immunity. Republican Joe Wilson of South Carolina sums up his party's position.
The Senate version has bipartisan support. It addresses all the concerns, particularly in regard to the ability to sue the telecommunications companies for their efforts to protect the American people.
Mike German, the ACLU's National Security Policy Counsel, who worked with the FBI for 16 years, explained why a more restrained approach to data collection is a win-win situation for government anti-terrorism efforts and the American public.
Mass data collection is unlikely to help in a counterterrorism mission where you're looking for specific individuals and a very small number of individuals. And, you know, while the Fourth Amendment is there to protect our rights, It's also there to focus law enforcement efforts on people they have reason to believe are actually engaged in wrongdoing.
The NSA's surveillance work links to about a dozen different anti-terrorism programs in a web that even intelligence officials admit may violate individuals' reasonable expectation of privacy. The NSA said in a statement that it strictly follows laws and regulations designed to preserve privacy rights and has admitted no wrongdoing. For FSRN, I'm Tanya Snyder in Washington.
The White House is firmly maintaining that the abrupt resignation of the top U.S. commander in the Middle East, Admiral William Fallon, was not an elimination of dissent. Admiral Fallon is a known opponent of attacking Iran and was asked just a few days ago about an Esquire magazine article in which he criticizes the Bush administration. Yet as rumors fly about Fallon's resignation or possible termination, Defense Secretary Robert Gates says the resignation was entirely Fallon's decision.
I believe it was the right thing to do, even though I do not believe there are, in fact, significant differences between his views and administration policy.
I'm joined on the line by Gareth Porter. He's an investigative historian and journalist on U.S. national security policy. So on one hand, Gates is saying that there aren't really any significant differences between Fallon's views and those of the administration's. But in the same breath, Gates says that it was the right thing to do. What does this mean?
Well, I think a safer way to interpret the Pentagon's position is to look at what happened in the 2 days prior to the Fallon resignation. If you read carefully what the Pentagon spokesman said when he was asked about whether Gates still had confidence in Fallon, the answer was rather clear that Gates did not have continued confidence in Fallon and that they were encouraging Fallon to resign. I think the impetus was really from both directions in this case for Fallon to resign. I think he was inclined towards that, and I think he made a move last November, December to cooperate with the Esquire magazine article, which he knew would probably increase the likelihood that he would end up having to resign. He simply felt that he was on the wrong side of a number of issues and that he wasn't able to move the policy in the direction he wanted. And he may have felt that he would be better off after retirement speaking out, and that's the hope of certainly that I have, that his resignation will result in his ability to speak more freely publicly.
So as you say, Fallon probably knew that this resignation was coming because it's very hard for a top commander to stand against the grain when you're surrounded by all these war hawks. Do you think that he will come out and speak now, and what might he tell us?
Well, this is hard to say, of course, what he has in mind, but the obvious comparison here is with Colin Powell, who knew a great deal about the issues that divided him from Bush and Cheney on the Middle East. And I suspect that he will address Iran, but that he's more likely to exert his influence on the issue of withdrawing troops faster from Iraq so that they can be used in Afghanistan. I think he feels very strongly about that, that Afghanistan is really the major threat, the major national security problem facing the administration in the Middle East, and that that's where U.S. troops really need to be sent.
I've been speaking with Gareth Porter. He's an investigative historian and journalist on U.S. national security policy. The paperback edition of his latest book, Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power, and the Road to War in Vietnam, was published in 2006. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni says his government will save the leader of the Lord's Resistance Army rebels, Joseph Kony, and his co-accused from prosecution by the International Criminal Court if the rebels sign a comprehensive peace agreement. Uganda's government has been holding peace talks for close to 2 years and last month signed a series of agreements with the rebels in Sudan, indicted by the International Criminal Court for war crimes. But the rebels have refused to sign a final peace deal until the ICC drops charges against their top commanders. FSRN's Joshua Chalimpa has the story.
Addressing journalists at the Commonwealth Secretariat in London, President Museveni said his government sought assistance from the ICC to handle the LRA case because they were not under their jurisdiction. And if they sign the peace agreement and return it to Uganda jurisdiction, it will become the responsibility of Uganda government and not any other party, including the International Criminal Court, to handle the matter. The government has already signed deals with the LRA in which the rebels agreed to stop abductions or rearmament and to limit their movement to temporary assembly area in South Sudan, where they will remain before disbanding. A ceasefire agreement formalizing the cessation of hostilities signed in mid-2006 created a 10-kilometer buffer zone around the LRA assembly area, guarded by South Sudanese troops. According to the 2006 agreement, the Southern Sudanese government will ensure that a full SPLA battalion is deployed for the protection of the assembly area, including the buffer zone. It also provides for a special division of Uganda's High Court to prosecute serious crimes committed in the war in northern Uganda. It circumvents the International Criminal Court, which was one of the demands of the LRA. Nyakora Chimatisanga is the chairperson of the LRA peace team and has been at The Hague to push the ICC to drop charges.
With the Rome Statute, that a clause that says a case cannot be referred to ICC only when the state cannot be able to prosecute those other, or they don't have a court that can actually handle the case. But in this case of LRA, the two parties already agreed that they are going to get alternative justice to make sure that the foreign that is can be handled through that system, whereby the system will be able also to meet the standard of the international court.
But President Museveni's statement and the rebel demands that indictments against them be lifted have evoked mixed reactions. The International Criminal Court Chief Prosecutor Luis Moreno Campo said in a statement that international arrest warrants against Joseph Kony and his commanders still stand despite the agreements signed. Uganda's Minister for International Relations, Okello Riem, also a member of the Uganda Peace Delegation to Juba Talks, says that what has been agreed on in the yet-to-be-signed comprehensive peace agreement between the government and the LRA rebels reflects the views of the people affected by the war.
The feeling of the victims is that there is need for forgiveness and reconciliation at this particular time to the perpetrators of the crime against them. And we hope that by the government and the community forgiving the perpetrators, the LRA, this will be the beginning of getting a final peace in Uganda. We think the mere fact that the community and the people are willing to forgive Kony, that will make it easier for him to sign a peace agreement.
He doubts if the LRA leaders will get a fair trial in Uganda. On the other hand, Human Rights Watch has welcomed the idea of setting up a special court in Uganda for the most serious crimes committed in the Northern War. Joshua Chalimpa, Free Speech Radio News, Kampala, Uganda.
Kenya's western region of Mount Elgon has been facing a land and air raid for the past several days from the Kenya Army together with the Kenya Police. The Army has been called in to assist in routing out armed militia that have been attacking and killing locals. It's estimated that more than 200 people have been killed there within the last year. FSRN's John Bwakali reports from Nairobi.
As Kenya comes to terms with the peace that has eluded the country for 2 months, the western Kenya region of Mount Elgon has erupted into renewed violence. Long before the post-election mayhem that rocked Kenya, the Mount Elgon region had been enmeshed in a 40-year-old conflict rooted in a post-colonial land dispute. The government says that a Kenyan army operation into the area was precipitated by a flare-up in the decades-old conflict. The army joined forces with the Kenya police to fight organized militia groups like the Sabaot Land Defense Forces and the Political Revenge Movement. These militia gangs claim that they are fighting for land that was rightfully theirs until the government brought in other people to settle in it. The army has been bombing cave hideouts of the militia. Godric Mwachofi, a program officer with Kenya Voluntary Development Association, explains. One local member of parliament of the region questioned the rationale of using the army, pointing out that the entry of the army and the subsequent land and air raids make it seem as if Kenya is at war with a part of itself. Indeed, local leaders have mostly been ambivalent about disarming the militia groups. Although the entry of the Kenya army seems to be quelling the situation, it seems to have introduced a new dimension to the conflict. Winnie, a program officer with the Regional Organization for Conflict Resolution, says that the police have previously appeared to do more harm than good in the region. Though the land appears to be a central issue for the conflict in Mount Elgon, the extent that politics is playing remains unclear. It is hoped that the prevailing national spirit of reconciliation will be fertile ground for a solution to be found in Mount Elgon sooner rather than later. Judging from the aggressive military onslaught, the government appears keen to solve the conflict by sheer force. it is yet to be seen if aggressive dialogue will also play a role. For Free Speech Radio News, I am John Bokali reporting from Nairobi.
Sri Lankan President Mahinda Rajapakse has ordered that country's elections commissioner to fix an immediate date for provincial council elections in the restive east. His order comes in the wake of Monday's successful local elections in the area, in which the defectors of the Tamil Tiger rebels have won 8 out of 9 local councils with the collaboration of the ruling political party. But the United National Party, the main opposition party, gathered outside the election office in Colombo to condemn the local poll in the east and urged the government not to hold provincial elections there. FSRN's Pania Monica Vasagam has the story.
On election day, in the eastern town of Batticaloa, the main streets were almost deserted except for troops who guarded the area from suspected attacks by Tamil Tiger rebels looking to disturb the polling. Sinithambi Yogarajan is a government employee who had just returned from a polling booth after casting his vote.
I have cast my vote in many elections in the past, but this is the first time I've seen so many police and soldiers guarding the streets and the polling booth. For the first time today, we voters were subject to body searches by the police. My neighbors were very silent when they went to cast their votes. They don't want to talk about the election or the candidates. We are all frightened that we may be harmed by the rival party members if they come to know for whom we have voted.
But housewife Batmini Seladure says the election and its outcome are meaningless to her.
We are facing many problems in our day-to-day life. We cannot travel freely from one place to another. There are restrictions. Life is not normal here. I don't think this election will solve our problems. Therefore, I did not go to vote. I don't want to vote.
United National Party and the Tamil National Alliance are the two major political parties that boycotted the elections because they say armed members of pro-government militants were in the running and there would be no safety for their candidates. Ranil Wickremesinghe, the opposition leader, accused the government of handing over the eastern province to another militant group through this election after liberating it from the Tamil Tiger rebels. Tamil National Alliance said the election has not been conducted in a truly democratic process. Last year, the government liberated the area from the Tamil Tigers with the support of the TMVP, means Liberation Tigers of Tamil People, a splinter group of the Tamil Tiger rebels. TMVP, Liberation Tigers of Tamil People, has emerged in the political scene after winning the local elections. This group is widely blamed for child recruitment, extrajudicial killings, and abductions in the East. The government is also blamed by the human rights groups for an unwillingness to intervene and stop human rights violations. But the government denied the charges. Pullayan is the vice president of the group. He says the victory in the election is the people's victory.
Existing politicians did not like the new arrival of our political party. Therefore, they say that there is a gun culture here. Actually, there is nothing here. We did not carry arms. People have voted for us and also voted for others as well. This is a democratic country. If there had been any intimidation or whatever, anyone could have lodged a complaint with the police. But no one has done so.
Pullayan told reporters that his party is prepared to work along with other political parties to solve the problems of the people in the area. The government says the people exercised their votes without fear and the election was free and fair. It also said that this election has politically weakened the Tamil Tiger rebels. The government says they are winning the war and after liberating the north, an election will be held to provide a political leadership to the Tamils there. But other countries, including India, are against the military move. There is opposition from the public and the major political parties in the country as well. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Ponnaiya Manikavasagam from Vavuniya, Sri Lanka.
The Bolivian government is in Vienna this week, making its case to the United Nations Commission on Narcotic Drugs that coca leaf should not be classified as an illicit drug. This comes in response to a call last week by the International Narcotics Control Board for Bolivia and Peru to abolish all uses of the coca leaf. Juliet Beck and Ardo Orellana Lopez report from Bolivia.
Arriving in La Paz, Bolivia, 12,000 feet above sea level, most visitors are offered an aromatic tea brewed from the leaves of the coca plant to stave off altitude sickness. Throughout the country, farmers, miners, taxi drivers, and students alike chew the leaves to provide a mild stimulant. Thus, the International Narcotics Control Board's call in their annual report for countries like Bolivia to prosecute anyone chewing coca or drinking coca tea is seen here as an offensive and even absurd assault on Andean culture. Lenny Oliveira, a university student in Cochabamba, describes why she and her Andean ancestors have chewed coca leaves for thousands of years.
Yo picheo porque me ayuda a concentrarme para estudiar y también porque...
On a daily basis, I chew coca because it helps me concentrate to study, and also after I eat, it helps digest nutrients. In terms of Andean culture, you can't just speak of coca in one context. It plays a role in ritual where it is very sacred. In its natural state, it is a medicinal plant, and in the religious context, it helps us to connect with nature.
Many drug policy experts consider it a historic error that the coca leaf was ever listed along with cocaine and heroin in the 1961 UN Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs. Catherine Lederberg, director of the Andean Information Network, explains.
The Single Convention was drafted in 1961. It created and perpetuated many misconceptions about the role of the coca leaf. I don't think that anyone who has any understanding at all would believe that it's a narcotic substance. It's something that gives you the rush about as strong as a cup of coffee. There were political interests in play when it was approved.
In the early 90s, Bolivian medical doctor Mario Argandoña led a study for the World Health Organization that concluded coca was harmless.
The study was over and was presented to the assembly in May 95. And the delegate of the U.S., Mr. Boyer, threatened the organization and the U.N. system with... Stopping any financial support to this organization if the study was published, because the study proved that coca leaves have no effect at all on human health.
Over the past 15 years, the U.S. has spent more than $25 billion in the so-called war on drugs to eradicate and interdict sources of cocaine in Latin America. This policy led to widespread human rights abuses and violent confrontations with Bolivian coca farmers in the 90s, but did little to stem the supply of cocaine. President Evo Morales, a coca grower himself, rose to the presidency as a leader of this resistance to an ill-conceived drug war. Since taking office, his administration has encouraged the use of coca in a variety of products, including cookies, pasta, toothpaste, and shampoo. These products are blocked from export by the 1961 convention, which the Bolivian government hopes to undo this week at the 51st session of the UN Commission on Narcotic Drugs in Vienna. The Federation of Coca Growers has threatened to occupy UN offices and Coca-Cola bottling plants. Catherine Lederberg explains why.
There is a special dispensation in the Single Convention that coca can be used as flavoring. That's something that caters specifically to the Coca-Cola company. The Coca-Cola company still buys the coca leaf and uses it as an element of its flavoring.
Lederberg also notes that if the goal is to eliminate narco-trafficking, the demand for cocaine in the U.S. and Europe must be reduced through education, treatment, and improving the social conditions that lead to cocaine addiction. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Juliet Beck and Aldo Orellana Lopez reporting from Bolivia.
From Pacifica Station, KPFK in L.A., I'm Aura Bogado.